News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Ed Halperin about the history of medical education in the United States. And Adam and I, as both are teachers of medical students and doctors in training, so this is of particular interest to us today. But first, we're going to talk about some other topics that may be interesting.
Well, medical training, Christy, can be really stressful for medical students and residents. And our first research article is about stress and whether stressful events are more likely to trigger a stroke. I know this is something that a lot of people worry about.
Sure. This was a study published in the journal Stroke to see if there was a link between distressing life events like the death of a family member or friend or job loss being related to a certain type of stroke called a hemorrhagic stroke or a subarachnoid hemorrhage.
Yeah. And, you know, this really comes about because many people really do believe that, you know, when they're stressed, their blood pressure goes up and that's going to maybe have them cause a stroke. And so these researchers looked at 470 people who almost 400 who had a stroke and compared them to these 400 others who had not had a stroke but were about the same age and comparable, and then looked to see to what extent both groups had these stressful events going on in their lives. And what did they find?
Well, initially when they looked at it, they did find a link between having financial or legal problems or stressful events with the timing of having one of these strokes. But then once they accounted for factors like having high blood pressure, smoking and drinking, things that we know are strongly linked to strokes, there was no difference.
Right. So this doesn't say that, you know, if you are under a lot of stress and your blood pressure goes up and it stays up for over a period of weeks and months, that you might still have a stroke, but you probably had underlying high blood pressure to start with. It wasn't like the stress itself created that high blood pressure, a sudden rise in the blood pressure and goes up. And so I think there's some more reassurance at least that it's not the stress itself, but it's the risk factors for the stroke that we really have to worry about.
I mean, at this point, we really need to focus on reducing those risk factors that we know, smoking and high blood pressure in particular.
Right, because we may not be able to do anything about stress, particularly as doctors and patients' lives and listeners' lives, but we can do something about your blood pressure. We can get you to quit smoking.
Absolutely.
Talking about things that we might be able to do something about, what's our next research that matters, Christy?
This is about the vitamin du jour, vitamin D, and the relationship between vitamin D and breast cancer.
Yeah, we've really focused our discussions over the last year about vitamin D deficiency and about supplements for vitamin D, and particularly its relationship to mobility and joints and problems of the muscles. And so this research was interesting to us about breast cancer because there's not a whole lot of things that we can offer and talk about that reduce breast cancer risk.
So there were some previous studies, Adam, that I think we've talked about on the show that vitamin D might reduce breast cancer risk. The idea is that breast cells have these receptors for vitamin D, and maybe they have something to do with the way the cells divide. So this was a study looking at over 3,000 breast cancer patients and more than 3,000 other people who didn't have breast cancer to try to see how much vitamin D they took in their food and whether they took supplements.
Right. And they did not find any relationships between overall vitamin D intake and breast cancer risk or overall calcium intake and risk. But they did find that the women who took a supplement of 400 international units of vitamin D, which is the minimum recommended amount or more that they – if these women took it, they had a 24% lower risk of developing breast cancer. And this was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition.
Well, I don't think we understand exactly how that works or whether one – it's a causal relationship. But it's encouraging to me as someone – I take vitamin D because I don't get sun and I'm good about protecting myself from skin cancer. And so it's reassuring to me that maybe that'll help decrease my breast cancer risk over time.
Right. What we don't know is, of course, is – what the optimal dose would be. Right. We don't know that what happens for people who don't need a vitamin D supplement if they're really taking this. We don't know that maybe the people who normally take this vitamin D are healthier to start with, and that's why they're looking to take things like the supplements, so maybe they have less weight problems, they drink less alcohol, known risk factors for breast cancer.
Yeah, less likely to smoke. I would agree with you, Adam. So
we don't think that this is cause and effect, but if you're taking vitamin D or you need to take vitamin D, maybe this is that extra reassurance that says, I should probably take it daily.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, the next one is about chocolate. If you are a chocolate eater, listen up.
Well, and, you know, I think this is an interesting research, Christy. This was in the Archives of Internal Medicine, and it's looking at the relationship between eating chocolate and being depressed. And I think we hear this from patients all the time, this, you know, when we're talking with people who are depressed about the fact that they eat a lot of chocolate, and that sometimes goes hand in hand. As the depression gets worse, they eat more chocolate. This isn't that good eating of chocolate that we talk about. This is a bad eating of chocolate.
It is. So this was in the Archives of Internal Medicine, about 930 women and men who were not using antidepressants, and they looked to find out any symptoms related to depression using some standard scales, and took in dietary information about how much chocolate they took in per day and per month.
Yeah, and you know what they found is that people who have major depression ate 11, almost 12 servings per month, which is about a third more than people who are not depressed. Well, the worst depression they did, the people who only have a minor depression still had more than the people who didn't have any depression. So it appears that the more depressed one is, the more chocolate one eats. But again, maybe that isn't all bad either, because this could signify perhaps maybe there's some self-treatment going on.
Sure.
Couldn't it?
It's definitely possible that the chocolate offers something that makes people feel better, and maybe that's why people are drawn to it. Perhaps it's the depression actually causes those cravings, or that eating a lot of chocolate makes you feel bad.
Yeah.
It's hard to know.
And I think regardless, it just makes us, as clinicians and physicians, more sensitive to understanding the role of people's habits as they get depressed. And maybe we can ask people, you know, how much chocolate are you eating? And if people who are having a lot of chocolate, maybe we should be a little bit aware that there may be some other things going on too.
And it may be part of this, the link between obesity and mental health issues, and understanding that is hard to know.
Yeah.
The next one is a lot more study on that one. The next one is a very difficult topic as well, and it's about children who lose a parent to suicide.
Yeah, and this was in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. And we know that suicide is a major issue, Christy. Almost over 10,000 children lose a parent to suicide each year. And the question, I think it's a good question, because the suicide of children, much less adults, is just so tragic. And they're more likely to die the same way if they've had a parent die that way. And that's not maybe you would say, oh, yeah, I think that could happen. But this just drives it home.
It really does. And this was one of the largest studies that's ever been done on this topic. It was done through the Johns Hopkins Children's Center and published in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. Big study done in Sweden over 30 years where they followed children and young adults who had lost a parent to suicide.
Yeah, over 500,000 children, teens, and young adults. And it certainly found that if you had a parent that had committed suicide, you have a significantly increased risk, you know, of dying that same way. And I guess one of the take-home points for me, Christy, is that we need to talk with both people who are suicidal, adults, and we always talk about ways and getting them into treatment. But, you know, they should know that this can have an effect on multiple generations, and also what we can talk to the children about really intervening early. This just means intervening early, trying to prevent these things.
I would agree with you, Adam. And I thought it was especially interesting that they found that people who lost a parent as children or teens were three times more likely to commit suicide themselves later in life than people who lost them as young adults. So there may be some developmental component or some particular timing of that event that also influences it. So perhaps we should pay even more attention to those folks.
Yeah, unfortunately, I was recently at the funeral of someone where it was said that their parent had committed suicide when they were a young age, and it really did haunt them for the rest of their lives. And we don't really want to have those types of stories. And so we really need to do everything we can. Well, I think that's conclude the research that matters today.
It does. We've had a chance to talk a little bit about strokes and stress.
About vitamin D and maybe cutting the breast cancer risk.
About an association between eating chocolate and depression.
And what we can do to maybe work with children who may have lost a parent due to trauma and violence and suicide. That'll conclude Research That Matters. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Ed Halpern about medical education in the United States over the last 100 years. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking about 100 years of medical education. It is the 100th anniversary of the Flexner Report, which was a monumentous report about the quality of medical education that changed the future of medical schools.
Yes, and Christy, we're really fortunate today. I think it's not often that we get a chance to reflect on how we got to where we're at in terms of the medical education that people maybe take for granted, but really maybe what's going to happen in the next 100 years of medical education. And we have with us today Dr. Ed Halpern, who has really just written a really interesting article in the journal Academic Medicine, the leading journal for educators in the country. And Dr. Halpern was a faculty member in radiation oncology at Duke University from 1983 to 2006, where he was chairman of the department from 1996 to 2002. After attending medical school at Yale University and serving as vice dean of the Duke School of Medicine, he attended Duke's graduate school during lunch in the evenings to earn an MA in liberal studies. He is currently dean of the medical school and professor of radiation oncology, pediatrics, and history at the University of Louisville in Kentucky, and we want to welcome him to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us. Dr. Halpern, as I was reading your bio, it really struck me, and Adam and I love to hear people's stories, and it really struck me that how does a radiation oncologist become a medical historian?
When I was on the faculty at Duke, I became interested in the history of the desegregation of hospitals in North Carolina, and I realized that many of the people who had been involved in racial desegregation of hospitals, medical societies, and medical staff services were still around if one sought them out and went to talk with them. So I drove around North Carolina with my office dictaphone and interviewed people who had helped desegregate hospitals, who had tried to stop the desegregation of hospitals, who had been involved in the desegregation of the North Carolina Medical Society. After I collected notes from a long time of gathering these oral histories, I wrote up my findings and submitted them to the New England Journal of Medicine, and that was my first medical history article, the history of the desegregation of hospitals and medical societies in North Carolina. That's my way of telling you I'm an amateur who got interested in it and was basically nosy about how things happened.
And just followed your passion.
Yeah.
I know that, you know, like a good ham operator who says that they're an amateur, but you see that they have a tremendous command over the literature and their field. I'm sure being a physician and someone who is at the top of the level must give you access to understanding events in history or insights into that. And I just wonder if, you know, if that's what led you to not only interested in desegregation, but all of the issues in medical history that you look at.
The important lesson, Adam, that I'd suggest to your listeners is that they appreciate that medicine is fundamentally a social activity, that it takes place in the context of changes in population demographics and the economy and changing social standards, and that if you really want to understand medicine, you have to understand the society in which it's practiced. And from where I'm sitting now, running a medical school and a health system, I'm acutely aware of that. And history is both a good story as well as instructive, as well as making you somewhat humble. Every time you think you're the first person to grapple with a problem, just study history and you realize that someone else has been through the problem before, perhaps with some differences and nuance, but fundamentally the same problem. So, you know, if you and I are going to talk about, if this conversation turned to current changes in healthcare policy or healthcare reform, American medicine in the 1960s had to deal with hospital desegregation. American medicine in the 1940s had to deal with religious discrimination. We've lots of times been through the problem of marginalized populations entering the mainstream.
Well, thinking about history repeating itself, the more I look back to that Flexner report that you wrote about so eloquently recently, the more I realize that these are a lot of the similar issues that medical schools are dealing with today. Let's transition a little bit to talk about that Flexner report and talk about the last 100 years of medical education history and how you got interested in that.
Abraham Flexner was from Louisville. He was a school teacher. He had gone to Johns Hopkins and got a bachelor's degree in Latin and Greek and came back and taught public school in a high school in Louisville and then opened up a prep school to get recalcitrant children ready to take their college entrance exams. He came to the notice of some prominent educators because of the success of his work as a high school teacher and got a master's degree in education. And in 1908, 1909, he was employed by the Carnegie Foundation to make a survey of American medical education and make some recommendations for reform. And I suppose that your listeners would want to know, well, why was that a big issue 100 years ago? It's because 100 years ago, the United States and Canada had over 160 medical schools. Most of them were appallingly bad. You could be a doctor in the United States without ever having gone to college. You could be a doctor by going to medical school for one semester programs in two successive years.
Wow.
You could be a doctor without ever having walked the wards, without ever having taken anatomy in any detail. You could be a doctor without ever having practiced under supervision. And some people began to be concerned about the quality of medicine and thought something should be done about it. And a variety of powerful people decided to employ this young former school teacher from Louisville, Kentucky, to take a train around the United States and Canada, take a look at the state of medical education, and make some recommendations. That's how the Flexner Report came to be, and it is that report which greatly reshaped American medical education.
Fascinating.
No, it's we're at the 100-year anniversary, which is, I assume, really one of the great reasons why you wrote this with your co-authors, this article, to reflect on really what it's achieved. And I think to most of our listeners, they may not have ever heard of Flexner or the Flexner Report. But as you pointed out, we had almost twice as many medical schools then as we do now, but maybe half the population of the United States. So there's these huge fundamental changes that occurred. And I wonder if you can begin to just to help us to understand what were the things that Abraham Flexner wanted to look at in the report. What were the four or five, six major areas in the training of physicians that he thought could be a problem or needed to assure were not a problem?
Well, Adam, let's think about it. Let's bring it close to home to your listeners. At the time Abraham Flexner began to worry about this, the state of North Carolina had a for-profit medical school in Charlotte. There was an African-American medical school in Raleigh, Shaw Medical School. The University of North Carolina Medical School was a two-year medical school of basic medical sciences. There was no medical school in Durham. That would not come for 20 years when Duke opened a medical school. And Wake Forest had a medical school. Cities like Chicago and Philadelphia had multiple for-profit medical schools, basically owned by physicians who collected fees from the students for giving lectures. And many of them were what we would call now diploma mills. So what did Flexner want to worry about? He wanted to worry about, one, what should be the pre-medical preparation to go to medical school? Two, what should the curriculum of a medical school actually be? Three, what was the responsibility of a medical school for running a teaching hospital? Four, how should you pay the faculty? Five, what did it mean to get a diploma? What should that entitle you to do? Six, did you need internship and residency training to go out and practice medicine? What Flexner was fundamentally grappling with was, for the first time in human history, medicine actually mattered. There were now antibiotics and x-rays and antiseptic surgery and anesthesia, and the public would begin to worry about a clean water supply and a clean food supply and drugs that actually worked, and they turned their attention to medicine and said, all these things are happening in medicine that might actually affect us. Maybe we should have doctors who are actually trained to do us some good.
Yeah, I love what you said, Dr. Halperin, in your article where you said for the first time in history, medicine actually mattered because there was more than a 50-50 chance of benefiting from the encounter. That's a little bit of humility, but it also suggests that the recognition that these things can make a huge difference in the quality of care people get.
Yes. It's a famous quote. It actually took me a while, Adam, to chase that down because I've heard that comment made, and I spent a while figuring out who actually said it, and it was a Harvard professor who said that about 1910, 1911 marks the first time in the history of the human race where a random person, chosen at random, could go to a random physician and stand better than a 50-50 chance of benefiting from the encounter.
Wow.
And so Flexner is the right guy at the right time. It's also the progressive era in American politics between the terms of Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. People started to care about this in the Great Reform era. And people said, well, I guess we'd better worry about the pipeline for training doctors. And Flexner methodically goes around the United States and looks at every medical school, analyzes it, sees what the physical plant looks like, the quality of the faculty, are the laboratories well maintained, is there actually an anatomy laboratory. He did some really simple things. He looked at the catalog to see if it was true. If a school claimed that it had an anatomy lab, he would say, show it to me. If it claimed that it had a biochemistry lab, he'd say, show it to me. If the catalog claimed that the medical students learned by going to an infirmary, he would say, I want to see it. Where are the beds? Where are the patients? Where's the faculty? And he proceeded to report on what he saw and made recommendations based on what he saw.
Fascinating. Then he made such a major impact on the next 100 years of medical education. We do need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Ed Halperin, about the history of medical education and in the past 100 years. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Ed Halperin about the last 100 years of medical education, and in particular, his recent article on the Flexner Report. And one of the things you said earlier in our conversation, Dr. Halperin, is about the relationship between medical education and understanding what's happening with clean water, with immunizations, antibiotics, various major steps forward in medicine. And in your report, you talked about Flexner's belief that preventive medicine might become more important than simply being focused on curing and treating ailments. Could you speak a little bit about his opinion on that and how that has shaped medical education?
Well, if you look at the leading causes of death in the United States 100 years ago, they were largely infectious disease, accidents, trauma, people falling off of wagons, being injured by railroad trains. And what we would now call a list of bacterial and viral infections were given rather generic names 100 years ago, death from diarrhea, death from cough. Why did many of those things get better? Did they get better because of specific doctors making diagnoses and treatment? Most people would say no. They got better because of a clean water supply, mm-hmm. because of reasonable housing conditions, better clothes, better nutrition, a sanitary system. Indoor plumbing.
So real
Flexner
public health efforts.
Pardon me?
Real public health efforts rather
than
on the individual
level. Flexner recognized all that. He wrote in his report that medicine is largely becoming community-based and preventative rather than individual. And Flexner recognized both that was important to the individual afflicted, but he also recognized that if your next-door neighbor was sick, he or she had the chance of transmitting it to you, so that you didn't want your next-door neighbor to get sick because it was in your own self-interest. Hmm. And he therefore argued that medicine had a responsibility for the health of the community. Now, to some Americans at that time, as now, them's fighting words. Oh, no, it's all individual responsibility. It's... You're on your own. We all rise or fall on our own through our individual self-efforts. And Flexner said, well, no, we're a community and we have to do things that are best for the community. He began with food and water and air and health education. We have continued those thoughts forward since the Flexner Report in tobacco control, public policy on alcohol, seatbelt wearing, vaccinations, etc.
Well, you know, speaking of fighting words that he did, I mean, you're talking about here he's fighting perhaps against a social construction of what medicine is, but also the social nature of at this time there were, as you talk about in the article, quite a few medical schools in the country that were really training African-American physicians. There were many more medical schools that were catering to women. And an impact of the report was a lot of those schools, perhaps maybe disproportionately so, actually closed due to some of the concerns, about, I guess, about quality. It was really interesting to read that you, however, say that he was actually a progressive on some of these issues of his time. How did he reconcile, on the one hand, perhaps being perceived as attacking those who might be under minority status, and yet at the same time he was really an advocate for those people's interest?
Well, what we're talking about, Adam, is that before the Flexner Report, there were about a dozen African-American medical schools in the United States. After the report, there were two, Howard and Meharry Medical School. Before the Flexner Report, there were some medical schools in the United States that were strictly women's medical colleges. After the Flexner Report, those decreased. Therefore, some people are quite quick to conclude that Flexner was anti-black and anti-women. It doesn't make sense. Flexner became chairman of the Board of Trustees of Howard University. Flexner marched in favor of women's suffrage. Flexner was a great defender of health care for African Americans and other marginalized populations. So what you just asked me is, you know, how do you reconcile that? It's maybe we can focus on a single quote. Flexner once wrote, there's no reason to make bad doctors and less of a reason to make a lot of them. Flexner's view was that you needed to concentrate your financial resources on where it would do the most good. And in his opinion, for African-American physicians, Meharry Medical School in Tennessee and Howard Medical School in Washington, D.C. were the best situated to graduate competent physicians in large numbers and make an impact. And he recommended concentrating money on those two schools rather than spreading it out over a dozen schools. For women in medicine, he recommended that all medical schools be co-ed and that all internship and residency programs be co-ed. And he said doing that would no longer mean that there needed to be separate medical schools for women. He spent a lot of time, because of his work with the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and the Carnegie Foundation, worrying about efficient and effective philanthropy. And it was his judgment that money ought to be best spent when it would get the highest yield for the benefit of the population.
You know, both Adam and I teach medical students now and teach residents and young doctors in family medicine. And I hear about the Flexner Report when a bunch of faculty members are together talking in a meeting, but not so much talk about it with medical students themselves, and not so much interest necessarily from medical students in hearing about what was going on 100 years ago. How do you make this relevant to students pursuing medical careers, and why should we?
It's the same reason why you and I as citizens think that no one should graduate from high school without having taken a year or two of U.S. history or a semester of North Carolina history or some civics. It's because we have decided as a society that to be an educated citizen in a democracy, you ought to know something about the evolution of the government of the United States and its history. And it's not a very big leap to think that if someone's going to be a competent physician, they ought to have some idea of how medical school came to be structured the way it is, how internship and residency came to be structured the way it is, why physicians care about certain things in the United States and why they play the role that they did. That's why medical students ought to know a little bit about the Flexner Report. And it's pretty remarkable that 100 years after a relatively obscure individual wrote a report, we're still talking about it. And that probably sends you a message that it must be pretty important, because how many other reports on education are still being talked about 100 years after they're written?
Or talked about at all.
And I guess the fact that it was accepted for publication in the leading academic journal also shows not only its broad interest, but also the rigor that you have brought. And I want to actually ask you something about your own views, Dr. Halperin, because, you know, I think as a historian, a medical historian who writes about this, you have some views about it. And clearly, you know, you talk about a quote in your article about that the Flexner Report, one of the brilliance of it was not necessarily that it was innovative, but it was catalytic. And I wonder if for you, is writing about these sorts of things catalytic in your viewpoint? Do you kind of hope that this jumpstarts people and that they use this information in ways that ultimately do lead to improvements in medicine, in this case, giving people a much greater history of the history of medicine that's relevant to them, that we can use your article perhaps as a way to interest medical students because it's a recent publication and it's shorter than going and reading the entire original Flexner Report?
Well, Adam, you know, it's an important question that you're raising, and why does this matter? If I asked you to tell me what the difference was between humans and non-humans, and you said, well, humans make tools, but then you say, well, no, chimpanzees can make some kinds of tools. Well, humans have language. Well, there is some sort of animal communication. Well, humans have music and other animals don't. Well, no, there is some animal music. But what is really the difference? It's that humans love to tell stories. They have got to tell stories. And that's embedded in medicine. All of medicine starts with the medical history. So what does all this matter? It means that the story of the Flexner Report and the story of medical education will resonate with people a lot more than saying, well, here's a printed piece of paper with the curriculum. How did it come to be? Why is it that way? What humans laid a hand on this medical curriculum and made it the way it was? Those are all very important. And because humans love stories, me telling the story of the Flexner Report will get some young people, I hope, interested in medical education, how it came to be, and how it could be better. The same way that telling you the story of George Washington crossing the Delaware or Abraham Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation might get you interested in doing some important things in your own time and saying, well, individuals did make a difference in the past. Maybe individuals can make a difference in the future.
Well, wow. What a nice
inspiring
story that tells us about yourself. And I think it does answer the question I posed. And I think that's a good place for us to take a break. That's a good story that perhaps they can listen to this radio interview, students and listeners alike, and I'm sure they'll be interested from your stories and sharing it with us. So thank you so much, Dr. Halperin, for sharing your stories.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for the work that you've done to make this relevant for us and being with us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Dr. Ed Halperin, Dean of the University of Louisville School of Medicine. And we've been very appreciative, but we're going to take a break, and coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your questions and health-related comments.
And you can send us your own experiences and questions. We will address them on an upcoming show. Send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. That's yourhealth@unc.edu.
And now we'll have our executive producer, Julie Steiner, read us some of the recent House Calls.
Dear Dr. Page and Dr. Goldstein, my friend told me she gets her medicines for $4 each at Walmart and that Target also sells them for $4. I have insurance, but my copays are all at least $10 and some are even $35. Can I get medicines for $4? And if so, how do I do that?
Great question. That really applies to a lot of people. You can get your medicines from $4 at Walmart or Target, and there are a variety of other places that do it, but your medicine needs to be on their list of medicines that they will provide for that cost.
Yeah, and there are a lot of medicines on the list in an increasing amount, and for a lot of people, that actually is a lot cheaper than traditional ways of getting their medicines in traditional pharmacies. I guess some people philosophically have a little bit of a problem sometimes with the larger corporate pharmacies driving the smaller independent pharmacies, you know, out of business. And there are other aspects of pharmacies besides the price about the relationship with the pharmacist and the counseling. So I don't want to make it sound like it's only black and white, only about money.
Well, and it's also confusing if you're going to one pharmacy, if you're going to Walmart to get certain medicines that are on their list and then run over to Target to get the other ones. It can be confusing both for you and for your doctor and the pharmacies to know what exactly you're taking and how much of it you're getting.
But certainly for lots of people, and Christy and I do refer lots of our patients to these types of pharmacies because in many cases it's much cheaper. And actually, I was just down in Florida, Christy, and some pharmacies were giving away the medicines free, the first month's supply free.
Wow.
Just to drive people into their pharmacy. So, you know, some of that is probably good for people.
So I'd tell you to talk with your doctor and review your medication list and find out which ones are most appropriate, if at all, to use that. But they can be $4 for a one-month supply and $10 for a three-month supply.
And sometimes there may be choices that your $4 medicine might not be on the list that your doctor prescribed, but there may be something equally good. And if you talk mm-hmm. with your doctor, they can look at that list. So maybe even print out the list and bring it with you to your doctor's appointment.
Great point, Adam.
What's okay. our very next house call?
I want to quit smoking, and I have cut down to 5 cigarettes a day. I only smoke when I'm at work, when I'm delivering mail. At night, I'm disgusted with myself and grossed out by the smell. But the next day, I'm driving my route, and I can't help myself from picking up another one for a smoke. Do you have any suggestions for me?
Well, first of all, let me say congratulations for deciding you want to stop smoking and that you're ready to do it. And good for you for cutting back. So you've made some strides.
The second thing is don't be disgusted with yourself. There's enough guilt going around. There's enough ill will towards smokers and social stigma that, you know, is out there. On the other hand, you do need to know that actually cutting down on the amount you smoke is not an evidence-based practice that doctors should recommend or that you should follow, because there's a problem is you do other behaviors that cause you to have nicotine levels much higher than you would expect.
Oh, like smoking in more, pulling more from each cigarette?
Yeah, you breathe each cigarette puff. More with a deeper puff. You smoke the cigarette longer towards the end of it. You take more puffs per minute. And finally, there's vent pores on the cigarette where normally air comes in and dilutes the nicotine. And most people do those tighter
pinch
and
it.
They block it. So you actually, instead of getting maybe levels of only 5 cigarettes, you think, you actually have levels that are much closer to 10 cigarettes a day, and you're probably still addicted to nicotine.
So in terms of strategies, I mean, one is to find a way to not buy cigarettes, to not have them in your car when you're driving your route. If they're not there, then it's really hard for you to give in to that temptation.
And we're going to strongly recommend that you probably work with a professional. There are tobacco treatment specialists. We have them at UNC Family Medicine, a nicotine dependence program. And make an appointment and see. Probably you might need to have some nicotine replacement therapy or other medications during the day that maybe help you to get off cigarettes for 3 or 4 months until your brain learns to not need to depend on the nicotine. That's a good start for you. You can look up on our website, ndp@unc.edu.
That's ndp@unc.edu?
Yep.
And congratulations again for your decision to stop smoking. You can do it.
What's
okay,
our
Julie.
Very next house call?
I got into some poison ivy this weekend, and my arms are covered with a painful and itchy rash. I'm trying to be really careful about keeping it from spreading to other parts of my body or to anyone else, but my husband told me that is a myth. Can you tell me how poison ivy spreads?
Very, very good question. It is a common myth that you can spread it to different people and across your body. The main way that it spreads is through contact with the actual plant. And then once it gets on or exposed to a part of your body, then in a couple of days, you tend to have that reaction. But it can stay on clothes or on your gloves, and then you can get it from where the gloves touch your skin as well.
Also, your body is – different parts of your body are going to react at different times. And so over the course of a week, you will have lesions break out every single day. And so it appears to you that it's spreading to different parts, but that's just wherever the oil touched. But sometimes it can come on one day, sometimes 3 days. And that's the problem. And it'll last 2 or 3 weeks. Another myth that people really should be aware of is scratching doesn't spread it. So you can't spread it, and you can't get it by touching it from someone else. So lots of myths out there. And maybe we should maybe even have a dermatologist on here, and we can talk a lot more about things like poison ivy, because people suffer, I think, a lot more than they need to. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things you can do by getting some prescriptions for it.
Okay, Julie, we have time for one last quick house call.
What is the blood test for anemia?
Oh, a quick one. Okay. Adam?
It's called a blood test called a hematocrit or a hemoglobin. And another way people would say it would be a CBC or a blood test. Any of those three things can really diagnose if your blood counts are low.
Yep. Very good question, and thank you for writing in to us. We want to thank all of you for your questions today. We've had a chance to talk about smoking and poison ivy.
A little bit about the blood test for anemia.
And about getting medicines from the $4 list.
Well, that's going to summarize what we can talk about today on our show. And we want to thank you for joining us today on Your Health.
We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. We want you to email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And you can also follow us on Twitter by searching at twitter.com for Your Health Radio.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great producer, Julie Steiner, and our great guest today, Dr. Ed Halperin. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
Take care.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.